It's hard to find the time to read all of the best articles on Bitcoin and the crypto economy. So let me read them for you. This is a Crypto Economy Quick Read. What is up, everybody? Welcome back to the Crypto Economy. We are doing some fun reading this week. This is the Crypto Economy. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know, and we are literally diving into, I am doing an audiobook this week, and it will be published entirely on the show for free, and it is an amazing, amazing book called Sovereignty Through Mathematics. If you have not read it, it is suggested by many as one of the essential reads for really understanding the foundations of Bitcoin and getting one of those large overviews of the entire system and what it's actually doing. And I am so excited. A huge thank you to Knut Svanholm for letting me read this and go into this piece. I mean, this is a book he has for sale on Amazon, and he was totally excited and wanted to have an audio version of it and is totally cool with having it available for free on the show. So another thank you to him. But let's not delay any further. Let's go ahead and jump in to Knut Svanholm's Bitcoin, Sovereignty Through Mathematics. Forward. At the time of writing, it is New Year's Day, and 2019 has just begun. For once, I have a resolution to live up to. I've promised myself to write a page a day, every day this year, until I have something real to publish. In June 2018, I published my first book, 3-Minute Reads on Bitcoin, A Year of Thoughts. The book consisted of articles I had published online from May 2017 and up to that point. This time, it's different. Instead of a mere collection of articles, I intend to write a proper book. A book that explains why Bitcoin is the most important invention of our lives. I didn't choose Bitcoin. It chose me. I had been trying to figure out how the world worked under the hood all my life, and then this simple idea of absolute scarcity popped up. It had a profound impact on how I view human interaction. Because of my curious nature, I fell deep into the rabbit hole instantly. I decided to educate myself on how this mysterious technology worked, and that got me into Austrian economics, which expressed very clearly what I had always suspected, that you really can't create value out of thin air. In this book, I will try to explain every aspect of what makes this technology so special, what sets it apart from the abundant, shameless copies of it, what's wrong with our current system, and what the future might look like. In just 2 days from the time of writing these words, we will celebrate the 10-year anniversary of the Genesis block, when the Bitcoin blockchain came into being. That block contained a message, a newspaper headline that read, "The 3rd of January 2009, Chancellor on brink of second bailout for banks." No one knows why Bitcoin's mysterious creator, Satoshi Nakamoto, chose to include this in the Genesis block. There is also some debate on whether the Genesis block was actually mined on the 3rd of January, since the next block wasn't mined until 6 days later. Somehow, Satoshi managed to stay hidden and weave several layers of mystique into the fabric of Bitcoin from the very beginning, which is part of what makes its conception so immaculate. This book aims to strip Bitcoin of its shady cloak and illuminate its true nature. After all, the only thing any person can do about the blockchain now is to study it. Note, in this book, Bitcoin, the system, is spelled with a capital B, and Bitcoin, the currency, with a small b. Chapter 1. Everything a Trade. All human interaction can be defined as trade. Yes, all human interaction. Every time a human being interacts with another, an exchange takes place. In every conversation we have, we exchange information with each other. Even the most trivial information is of some value to the other person. If information didn't have any value to us, we wouldn't talk to each other. Either what the other person says is valuable to us, or we find it valuable to give information to them, oftentimes both. At the core of all human interaction that isn't violent, both parties perceive that they gain some value from it. Otherwise, the interaction would not have taken place at all. Civilizations begin this way. Two people finding it valuable to interact with each other. That's all it takes. So what constitutes value? What we find valuable is entirely subjective. A comforting hug, for example, probably has a different value to a 2-year-old than it has to a withered army general. Even the most basic action, such as breathing, encapsulates the whole value spectrum. We tend to forget that even a single breath of air can be of immense value to us under the right circumstances. A single breath is worth more than anything on the planet to a desperate freediver trapped under ice, while worth nothing to a person with a death wish in clean forest air on a sunny summer day. Value is derived from supply and demand is always subjective. Supply is not. Since all of our lives are limited by time, time is the ultimate example of a scarce, tradable resource. We all sell our time. We sell it to others and we sell it to ourselves. Everyone sells their time, either through a product that took them a certain time to produce or as a service, and services always take time. If you're an employee on a steady payroll, you typically sell 8 hours of your day every day to your employer. If you're doing something you truly love to do, that 8-hour day still belongs to you in a way, since you're doing what you'd probably be doing anyway if you had been forced to do it for free. Sometimes we sacrifice time in order to acquire something in the future. An education, for instance, gives no immediate reward, but can lead to a better paying, more satisfying job in the future. An investment is basically our future self trading time with our present self at a discount. Once again, every human interaction viewed as trade. It's rooted in physics. For every action, there is an equally large reaction. Trade is at the very core of what we are, and the tools we use to conduct trade matter a lot to the outcome of each transaction. Money is our primary tool for expressing value to each other, and if the creation of money is somewhat corrupt or unethical, that rot spreads down throughout society, from top to bottom. Shit flows downhill, as the expression goes. So what is money, or rather, what ought money to be? In order for two persons to interact, when a mutual coincidence of needs is absent, a medium of exchange is needed in order to execute a transaction. A mutual coincidence of needs might be, you need my 3 goats and I need your cow, or even, both of us need a hug. In the absence of a physical good or service suitable for a specific transaction, money can fulfill the role of a medium of exchange. What most people fail to realize is that the value of money, just as the value of everything else, is entirely subjective. You don't have to spend it. The problem with every incarnation of money that mankind has ever tried is that its value always gets diluted over time due to inflation in various forms. Inflation makes traditional money a bad store of value, and money needs to be a good store of value in order to be a good investment. Or in other words, a good substitute for your time and effort over time. Bitcoin tries to solve this by introducing to the world absolute scarcity, a concept that mankind has never encountered before. To comprehend what such a discovery means for the future, one needs to understand the fundamentals of what value is, and that we assign a certain value to everything we encounter in life, whether we admit it or not. In short, we assign value to everything we do. Value is derived from supply and demand, and supply is objective, while demand is subjective. Free trade emerges out of human interaction naturally, and it is not an idea that was forced upon us at any specific point in time. The idea that markets should be regulated and governed, on the other hand, was. Free trade is just the absence of forceful interference in an interaction between two humans by a third party. There's nothing intrinsically wrong or immoral about an exchange of a good or service. Every objection to this is a byproduct of the current global narrative, a narrative that tells us that the world is divided into different nations and that people in these nations operate under various sets of laws, depending on what jurisdiction they find themselves in. All of these ideas are man-made. No species except humans does this to themselves. Animals do trade, but they don't do politics. Bitcoin and the idea of truly sound, absolutely scarce money inevitably makes you question human societal structures in general, and the nature of money in particular. Once you realize that this Pandora's box of an idea can't be closed again by anyone, everything is put into perspective. Once you realize that it is now possible for anyone with a decently sized brain to store any amount of wealth in that brain, or to beam wealth anonymously to any other brain in the world without ever knowing, everything you were ever told about human society is turned on its head. Everything you thought you knew about taxes, social class, capitalism, socialism, economics, or even democracy falls apart like a house of cards in a hurricane. It is in fact impossible to comprehend the impact Bitcoin will have on the planet without also understanding basic Austrian economics and what the libertarian worldview stems from. Imagine growing up in an Amish community. Until your 16th birthday, you are purposefully completely shielded off from the outside world. Information about how the world really works is very limited to you, since internet access and even TVs and radios are forbidden within the community. Well, from a certain perspective, we're all Amish. How money really works is never emphasized enough through traditional media or public educational institutions. Most people believe that the monetary system is somehow sound and fair when there's overwhelming evidence to the contrary, all over the globe. Ask yourself, do you remember being taught about the origins of money in school? Me neither. I don't believe that there's some great global conspiracy behind the fact that the ethics of money creation isn't a school subject, but rather that plain old ignorance is to blame for the lack of such a subject primarily. As soon as their math skill limit is reached, people seem to stop caring about numbers. The difference between a million and a billion seems lost on a depressingly large part of the world's population. In the chapters ahead, we will explore the pitfalls of central banking, how money pops into existence, and how inflation keeps us all on a leash. Chapter 2: Financial Atheism. Don't trust, verify, is the slogan of a prominent Bitcoin company. The saying represents a sound attitude towards not only Bitcoin, but all human power structures. In order to understand Bitcoin, one must admit that everything in society is man-made. Every civilization, every religion, every constitution, and every law is a product of human imagination. It wasn't until as late as the 17th century that the scientific method started to become the dominant practice for describing how the world actually worked. Peer-to-peer review and repeated testing of a hypothesis is still quite a recent human practice. Before this, we were basically just guessing and trusting authorities to a large extent. We still do this today, and despite our progress in the last couple of centuries, we still have a long way to go. Our brains are hardwired to follow the leader of the pack. The human brain is born with a plethora of cognitive biases, pre-installed, and we have to work very hard to overcome them. We evolved to survive in relatively small groups, and our brains are thus not really made for seeing the bigger picture. Bitcoin's proof-of-work algorithm is constructed in such a way that it is easy to verify that computational power was sacrificed in order to approve a block of transactions and claim its reward. In this way, no trust in any authority is required, as it is relatively trivial to test the validity of a block and the transactions it contains. This is nothing short of a complete reimagining of how society ought to be governed. The beauty of mathematics governs the Bitcoin system. Everything that ever happens in Bitcoin is open and verifiable to everyone, even those that are not yet using it. After the tragic events of September 11, 2001, Sam Harris started writing his book, The End of Faith, which happened to be released around the same time as Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion, Daniel Dennett's Breaking the Spell, and Christopher Hitchens' God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. These books kickstarted what in hindsight has often been referred to as the New Atheist Movement, even though there has arguably never been anything new about atheism. Atheism must almost certainly have preceded religion, since religious ideas require the person holding the idea to believe a certain doctrine or story. Atheism is nothing but the rejection of ways to describe the world that are not verifiable by experimentation. A fly on the wall is probably an atheist by this definition of the word. Atheism is often accused of being just another set of beliefs, but the word itself describes what it is much better: a lack of belief in theistic ideas. It is not a code of conduct or a set of rules to live your life by. It is simply the rejection of that which cannot be scientifically verified. Many people, religious people in particular, have a hard time grasping this. If you believe that a supernatural entity created everything in everyone's life, you might not be too comfortable with a word that describes a complete rejection of what you believe created everything, including the very atheist that the word describes. The amount of different religious worldviews that exist is probably equal to the sum of all religious people on the planet, but all worldviews that reject these superstitious beliefs require but one word. Atheism is not the opposite of religion, but is simply the lack of it. In 2008, another subculture movement of unbelief was born. Let's call it financial atheism, the rejection of unverifiable value claims. With the invention of Bitcoin, a way of rejecting fraudulent expressions of a token's value was born. Those of us fortunate enough to have been born in secular countries all enjoy not having the ideas of religious demagogues dictating our lives on a daily basis. We can choose which ideas to believe in and which to reject. What we still have very limited means of choosing, however, are the ways in which we express value to each other. We're told to use a system in which we all have a certain number of value tokens assigned to our name, either as a number on a screen or as digits on paper notes. We all live in the collective hallucination that these numbers are somehow legit and that their authenticity is not to be questioned. A Bitcoin balance assigned to a certain Bitcoin address might seem just as questionable to a layman, but if you have a basic understanding of the hashing algorithms and game theory behind it, it's not. At the time of writing, the hash of the latest block on the Bitcoin blockchain begins with 18 zeros in a row. These zeros represent the proof of work that ensure that this block is valid and that every transaction in it actually happened. If you can grasp the concept of a hashing algorithm, and if you can have an intuition about mathematics, you realize the gargantuan amount of calculating effort that went into finding this particular hash. It is simply mind-blowing. To forge a false version of a hash with 18 zeros in the beginning just wouldn't be economically viable. Of course, you can never actually know that a 51% attack or some other attempt at corrupting the blockchain hasn't occurred. But you can know that such an attack would require more than half of the network acting against their own economic interest. Bitcoin is not something to believe in. You don't need to trust any authority because you can validate the plausibility of its authenticity yourself. It's the financial equivalent of atheism or unbelief. Satoshi wasn't Jesus. Satoshi was Brian of Nazareth, telling his followers to think for themselves. The first law of thermodynamics, also known as the law of conservation of energy, states that energy cannot be created or destroyed in an isolated system. The second law states that the entropy of any isolated system always increases. And the third law states that the entropy of a system approaches a constant value as the temperature approaches zero. In the Bitcoin network, participants known as miners compete for new Bitcoin in a lottery with very fixed rules. The more hashing power or computing power a miner contributes to the network, the higher his chances of winning the block reward, a specific amount of Bitcoins that is halved every 4 years. The difficulty of this lottery, in other words, the miner's chance of winning it, is recalibrated every 2,016th block, so that the average time it takes to find the next block is always roughly 10 minutes. What this system produces is absolute scarcity. The number of Bitcoin in existence at any moment in time is always predictable. The more time that passes, the slower the rate of coin issuance, and the block reward slowly approaches zero. By the time it does, around the year 2140, the individual miner's incentive to mine for a reward will, at least theoretically, have been replaced by an incentive to collect transaction fees from the participants of the network. Even now, the sum of all fees make up a non-trivial part of the miner's revenue. Yet, from a user's point of view, the fees are still very low. And as the network scales up using Layer 2 solutions such as the Lightning Network, they're expected to remain low for quite a long time ahead. Absolute scarcity is a concept that mankind has never encountered before. Arguably, this makes it the first man-made concept to ever be directly linked to the laws of physics. Everything anyone does requires a certain amount of energy. The very word doing implies that some kind of movement, some type of energy expenditure, needs to occur. As mentioned earlier, how we value things is entirely subjective. Different actions have different value to different people. How we value different things is also inevitably linked to the supply of that thing. Had the trapped under ice winter diver mentioned in Chapter 1 been equipped with a scuba tank, he probably wouldn't have thought of his next breath as such a precious thing. The price a person is willing to pay for a good, in other words, the sum of one or more person's actions, can be derived from two basic variables: the highly subjective demand for the good, and the always constrained by time and space supply of that same good. Note that if supply is sufficiently limited, there only needs to be a minimal amount of demand for a good for its price to increase. One could argue that no one needs Bitcoin, and therefore Bitcoin would have no intrinsic value. One could also argue that there's no such thing as intrinsic value since demand is always subjective. In any case, there will always be a cost to mine a Bitcoin, and the more mining power in the network, the higher that cost. This cost, ensured by the Bitcoin network's proof-of-work algorithm, is probably as close to a pure energy cost as the price of a human activity will ever get. Once the mining rig is in place, a simple conversion process follows. Energy in, scarce token out. Should the cost of production exceed the current price of the token, the miner can just choose to not sell, thereby limiting the supply of Bitcoins in circulation even more and eventually selling them for other goods, whenever he so sees fit. In this sense, Bitcoin is a battery. Perhaps the best battery ever invented. Storing and moving electrical energy around has always been costly and wasteful. Bitcoin offers a way of converting energy into a small part of a specific number. a mathematical battery, if you will. It is important to remember that it does not convert energy into value directly, but rather electricity into digital scarcity. Digital scarcity, which can be used to express value. Energy cannot be created or destroyed in an isolated system, as the first law of thermodynamics clearly states. Bitcoin can express how much energy was sacrificed in order to acquire a share of the total sum. You can also acquire bitcoins by buying them rather than mining them, but in doing so, you also spend energy. You somehow acquired the money with which you bought the bitcoins. You or someone else sacrificed time and energy somewhere. Bitcoin lets you express that you see that there's a connection between value and scarcity by letting you sacrifice effort to claim a part of the total sum of them. The excitement we so-called Bitcoin maximalists feel about Bitcoin does not come primarily from the enormous gains that those who hopped early onto the freight train have been blessed with. Nor is it because we're in it for the technology, as can often be heard from opponents. Those of us that preach the near divinity of this invention do so above all because we see the philosophical impacts of absolute scarcity in a commodity. The idea of a functioning solution to the double spending problem in computerized money is an achievement that simply cannot be ignored. By solving the double spending problem, Satoshi also made counterfeiting impossible, which in turn makes artificial inflation impossible. The world-changing potential of this invention cannot be understated. Not in the long run. The more you think about it, the more the thought won't give you any peace of mind. If this experiment works, if it's real, it will take civilization to the next level. What we don't know is how long this will take. Right now, debates in the Bitcoin space are about Bitcoin's functionality as a medium of exchange and its potential as a good store of value. We might be missing the point. We cannot possibly know if a type of monetary token for which you are completely responsible with no third-party protection will ever become a preferred medium of exchange for most transactions. Nor can we know if the price of Bitcoin will follow the hype cycle path that we all want it to follow, so that it can become the store of value that most maximalists claim that it already is. Maybe we've been focused on the wrong things all along. Maybe Bitcoin's greatest strength is in its functionality as a unit of account. After all, this is all that Bitcoin does. If you own 21 Bitcoins, you own 1/1,000,000th of the world's first absolutely scarce commodity. This might not make you rich overnight, but it just might have something to do with the opportunities available to your great-great-grandchildren. Throughout history, whenever a prehistoric human tribe invented ceremonial burial, that tribe began to expand rapidly. Why? Because as soon as you invent belief in an afterlife, you also introduce the idea of self-sacrifice on a larger scale. People that held these beliefs were much easier for a despot to manipulate and send into battle with neighboring tribes. Religious leaders can use people's fears and superstitions to have them commit all sorts of atrocities to their fellow man, and they still do so today. Belief in a greater good can be the most destructive idea that can pop up in a human mind. The Nazis of World War II Germany believed that exterminating Jews was for the greater good of their nation's gene pool. Belief in noble causes often comes with unintended side effects which can have disastrous consequences. Religious leaders, political leaders, and other power-hungry sociopaths are responsible for the greatest crimes against humanity ever committed, namely wars. We Europeans often question the Second Amendment to the United States Constitution, which protects the right to bear arms whenever a tragic school shooting occurs on the other side of the Atlantic. What everyone seems to forget is that less than 100 years ago, Europe was at war with itself because its citizens had given too much power to their so-called leaders. The Nazis came to power in a democracy. Never forget that. Our individual rights weren't given to us by our leaders. We were born with them. Our leaders can't give us anything. They can only force us to behave in certain ways. If we truly want to be in charge of our lives, we need to find the tools necessary to circumvent the bullshit ourselves. Chapter 3. The Gullible Collective. All right, we will stop reading here for today, but there are a number of ideas that he brings up in the first two chapters here that I really want to talk about. So let's hit our sponsor real quick, and I'm going to go grab some water, and then we'll come back and jump into this. All right, before we dive in, just to remind everybody, this is by Knut Svanholm. I will have the links to the book and the author's Twitter page and a couple of other things in the show notes, so you definitely should go check that out and should definitely be following him. We will be reading this piece for the rest of the week because there's literally a lot of great stuff in here. And I love chapter one, just how he starts this book off, I think is just, it's such a critical piece of like the foundation of how to think about all of this, is that everything is a trade. And this is a really fundamental idea that all of our interaction is a choice and we are exchanging things with each other. And communication, language, and money are both means of facilitating transactions in different mediums. Language is a way to codify and allow us to exchange information, exchange patterns of ideas and behaviors in the world. Like the reason that we interact with language is because, like, I've used this analogy before, but that like all I'm doing is really just making a ton of random nonsensical noises. But because we have the same codification of what those noises and clicks and all that stuff, what it all means, like what sort of pattern it essentially morphs into within our brains, is that we can actually apply it to a thing. So I can tell you or describe to you how to accomplish something, and then I have transmitted a behavior. I have transmitted a sequence of actions, you know, halfway around the world in a matter of seconds or minutes, however long it takes for the description to leave my mouth and enter your head and to make some semblance of the same idea that I was trying to get across. And I could, you know, we have the possibility of like communicating. I could save you time. I could save you money. Or you could give me an idea and make me realize that I was thinking about something completely wrong, and I would completely change my actions in response to that. That we can literally begin to consume all of this information. Like, we could see the world from completely different areas, from completely different lives, and then share those ideas to test them out in a wide array of different places and locations and situations. And because of that, we become a networked organism in that way. And that's why having, you know, like detailing out what your definition or your goal is before even having a conversation, particularly before having a debate, is one of those things that's critically important to make sure that you're speaking the same language. That's why I refer to Bitcoin and, well, that's why I refer to money as a language of value, because it is that thing which allows us to all be on the same relationship between one good and all the billions of various goods we could choose between. So as long as we have an established relationship with one good that we have in common, well, then we can then communicate the value of the billions of other goods that we know of or have used or don't know of, et cetera, et cetera. So we get to do that same thing for how we value things, for the information and the knowledge and the actions that we have, that like money allows that for value, that language does for information. And the ability to coordinate that, the ability to share that information, both the value and the sheer communication, makes the spread of efficiency, the spread of bettering our lives, an exponential process rather than a linear individual one, an exponential and networked process. And it's exactly what we've seen with the internet. The explosion of wealth in the last 20 or 30 years is entirely unprecedented. And that is from connecting people and connecting the ability to share information with more people faster. And that same thing will happen on an unbelievably larger scale when it comes to Bitcoin. When we do that for money, not only just in the enabling of a standardized means of communicating value, not only is that alone an incredibly powerful tool, but to eliminate the concept that, or to eliminate the bleed from that communication, that inflation is, that the corruption of money is, that the wealth confiscation of the financial elite and the political institutions that we currently see in modern society, that is almost, that we're talking about just that alone. If it was not even a better measure and it was not more scarce or more sound, just alone eliminating the counterfeiting problem is worth multiple trillions of dollars, if not more, tens, maybe $20 trillion. Like, it's, you cannot under, he says it in this piece, you can't underestimate how much impact this could have if what it is real. If this is really going to work at the scale and in the way that we think it is, the impact that it could have will just make everything else look ridiculous. Like, that's why it's one of those things that's just so consuming, because it's everything else pales in comparison. It's like, if there is a measure of what I could do with my time and what will have the most impact on the world, when you fully grasp the impact of a standard medium for communicating value and one that is incorruptible and is totally unbiased and objective in all of its monetary properties, it's incredibly hard not to be consumed with it, because everything else just seems so inconsequential in the face of it. It's like, you know, it feels like maybe wasting your time on trying to make a car that goes just a little bit faster, the incredible amount of work that it would take to do that, when someone has just invented teleporting and you're pretty sure it could be cheap and widely available. It's like, how could I spend my time on the car? You know, like, in the face of that, like, that would just be eating at me every day and night. I'm wasting my time on this car. Someone has invented teleporting. What am I doing with my life? Like, that's what Bitcoin does. Like, when I feel like when I really wrap my head around what I thought the impact of this technology was going to be, that's kind of how it felt. Every time I went to something else, like, I would slowly get pulled back, because my brain is like, what are you doing? What are you doing? This is not nearly as important. Another one of the major ideas is of absolute scarcity. That was always one that, and I don't remember exactly when that flip switched. It was actually years after I got into Bitcoin. Like, the idea of a scarce money was always fascinating, but I never stopped to think about how that scarcity really applied in the rest of our lives. Like what, essentially, that we had nothing to compare to that is as scarce as Bitcoin. Everything else we could want more of, we can always make more of in some form or fashion. And that includes gold and, you know, supposedly naturally scarce commodities. You know, we can turn one element into another. It just takes an unbelievable amount of energy. We can always, you know, if we have the energy to go to other planets and, you know, mine comets or whatever that kind of come through our solar system, there's plenty of it out there. It's just an incredibly costly endeavor. Whereas Bitcoin, even with the fact that its issuance is indeed a highly costly endeavor, it is still absolutely scarce. The schedule, the monetary schedule, cannot be contradicted just because you have a lot of energy. That's what makes it so. That's what makes the price so volatile, particularly at this point in time, is because the supply is perfectly inelastic, which means that the demand, the price, With fluctuations in demand, the price is the only thing that can adjust. So the price is actually an incredibly accurate in, you know, quote unquote, in the degree that a price can be accurate, to a near objective collective view of what the value of Bitcoin is. Now, there is no perfect price. There is no perfect equilibrium. Everything is in constant flux. Every second that goes by, the truth of that changes. So when you, it's important to think about an equilibrium price as a constantly adjusting thing. Like, there is no such thing really as the equilibrium price. It's just a constant limit or a trend towards finding equilibrium. It's like saying, when are we going to be done learning things or receiving and applying new information? Like, that's 100% impossible. Like every second brings in new information and new knowledge and spreads current knowledge further, and works out contradictions between two ideas that are out there, et cetera, et cetera. Like, nothing. There's no such thing as being done learning, particularly as a species. That's what I mean when I say, like, it's leading towards the equilibrium price. And the fact that its supply is perfectly inelastic means that it actually can be a vastly better pricing mechanism than anything we've had before. So it would just be an incredibly phenomenal thing to be able to look at. Like, I think the current price movements that we see in Bitcoin, I think in the future, I think already, really, it's definitely begun. There's so much thought, new thought in economics now, and I think a lot of it centers around Bitcoin and its new and old ideas. New ideas that have, you know, never really been presented before, and old ideas that were dismissed back into people's thinking, back into the forefront, and making us readjust where we have seen incredible imbalances take place. Like we're able to look at the world through a new lens and suddenly see things that see the causes of massive problems we've had that we've not been able to pinpoint, or that we have improperly assigned to other ignorances or misinterpretations of our world. Speaking of worldviews, the financial atheism was a pretty interesting idea that I had sort of thought about it, because it's funny, particularly in the kind of anarchist libertarian communities, there are a lot of people who will, I think, accurately refer to as government and the idea of a nation state as a religion. It's an organized religion. It really is. It's the idea that as long as people are in certain positions, they should have different sets of power, and that, you know, and, you know, based on like a popularity contest and stuff, like, it's really kind of an elaborate way to designate, you know, alphas and leaders in a society that have a different set of rules applied to them. So, and there's nothing quite so corruptible, I guess you could say, that has the level of moral hazard as an imbalance in the power over money. There is nothing. It's like saying that, imagine if there was one person who could modify at a whim, they could modify the definition of a word to mean something entirely different and make someone who had said something completely innocuous, now they've just threatened murder, or they've committed fraud. That you could just change the nature of a word so that things that have already been said in completely different contexts. It's actually funny. That's really what politics does a lot of times. Is it manipulates our understanding and the usage of words to make something evil sound good and useful, and to make something sound really good terrible and awful. So you could actually argue that's kind of what politics does. But think about that in the context of money, how dangerous that is in both situations, how unbelievably dangerous and awful that is to screw up efficiencies in communicating, to create miscommunications on purpose to make us hate each other or misunderstand what the other person's experiences or perspective are. And to do that in money is to A, both destroy our ability to trade, which means the person who has food doesn't know how to properly get the value of that food to the person who needs to eat, and the person who builds the houses doesn't know how to properly communicate value with the person who is making the food, and the guy who has the house doesn't have any food, and the guy who has food doesn't have a house. Like, that's what we're talking about. That's why if money falls apart, society falls apart. Everything is only possible because, I mean, there's an infinite number of things practically. You could continue to go down smaller and smaller into trying to figure out all of the things that you have around you in your life, in the room that you're sitting in right now, that you can't make without trading someone else for. Like, the number of things that we have in our lives in which we depend on other people is almost infinite. Like, we are not, like, any degree of dependency we have is an extrapolation of the dependencies that we've already had in the last, you know, 50,000, 100,000 years since the birth of civilization and the exchange from one person to another. We are standing on the shoulders of billions of people already, and the entire market is that. It is our interdependence on each other. So if we cannot communicate in that market, it falls apart. And if we don't have that market, we don't have anything. I don't have a microphone. I don't have a screen. I don't have a roof over my head. I don't have a hammer or a saw to even begin to do that. I don't know how to cut down a tree. Like, I can't do anything without being able to trade and communicate with other people around me. Nobody can. That's why when money falls apart, like in Venezuela, everything falls apart. People starve. People end up breaking into, I saw a video, an awful video of a bunch of people just climbing a fence on somebody's farm and literally killing and tearing a cow apart just so they could get some of the meat. Like, just a bloody mess of people destroying a cow, like a bunch of wild animals, because the money doesn't work anymore. That's the only reason that they are resorting. They have to resort to that. And to think how much of our problems in society today are caused by the corruption of our money. Like, we have a government that corrupts our money to 5 to 10% of its ability to communicate value, and runs endless wars all the way around the world and spreads this out, manages to dump this inflation and counterfeiting of value onto so many other countries around the world as, you know, being the world police and the world reserve currency in the US. Like, how, if the total destruction of money creates the total destruction of trade and causes homelessness and starvation across the entire society, like in Venezuela, and in numerous other countries, some 50, 60 odd countries that this has happened to in the last century. If that's what happens when you completely destroy the money, what happens when you destroy the money 5% or 10%? Would you not get a slow, gradual trend in that direction? Do you think it's perfect? It's actually better at 3% to, you know, manipulate the definitions of words, to manipulate the value of money. But at then at like 5%, it starts to get wishy-washy, and then 10%, it's bad. It seems to me far more likely that this is a principle. Either it's good that we all believe the same thing about the definitions of our words and the value of our things, or it's bad. Like, I don't see how there could be any minor benefit to being able to miscommunicate with people more often. Even if it's like what we need is like 2% miscommunication. That's kind of what we're talking about. When you say we want to have 2% inflation across the economy, it's that for 2% of our conversations, we want to not understand each other. How does that make any sense? So anyway, so that's financial atheism. It's the verification that this is a little bit off from financial atheism, but I hope the idea got across. But the idea of financial atheism is that we verify established independent rules for which to define the value of our money. It's as if we have an objective way to know that everybody is using the same definitions of words, that we're all using the same language. And the amount of efficiency and wealth creation that we can get from that is unbelievable, because we're no longer leaving it up to our leaders to define what value means for us. We are doing it ourselves. And that's why I stress so much that verification, that validation of Bitcoin is what makes it powerful. Because without validation, you don't have anything. You can't know even that you're using Bitcoin if you're not validating it against the rules of Bitcoin. It's all just a digital ledger in the end. You have to validate the math to know that the math is real, to know you've got a real Bitcoin. So if you're not sovereign, if you're not validating, that's why gigabyte blocks, nope, never going to use it. I am never going to use something that has gigabyte blocks, because there is simply no way to validate that amount of information all the way back to the Genesis block so that I know without question that what I am using is Bitcoin, and that I am using a strict monetary policy that has not been altered or counterfeited or corrupted in any way whatsoever. Verification is the value of that system. And I will verify, and I will only ever trust a system digital that I can verify. I would only trust any system that I can verify. Otherwise, I'm just trusting somebody else. Why didn't I just use the bank? Good title for this book too, by the way. If Knut listens to this all the way through, Sovereignty Through Mathematics, love that title. But anyway, I'm actually a little bit low on time here. I think I'm going to have to close this out for today. We will keep digging through this work until we get to the end of it. We'll finish it this week. I'll be able to get through it in the week. Stay tuned. Don't forget to subscribe to the show so that you can hear more of this awesome piece, Sovereignty Through Mathematics. And I'll be dropping the full audiobook and throwing that to Knut so you can get this in full later. Don't forget to subscribe to the show. Follow me on Twitter at The Crypto Economy, and you can check out thecryptoeconomy.com. I've actually got a new landing page now, and I have been trying to come up with a more streamlined way to keep updated with these posts. So I'm going to be jumping back into the website a lot more thoroughly than I have. So check out thecryptoeconomy.com and let me know what you think of the new landing page. And of course, don't forget you could support this show. I've got a tipping jar and a donation address up there on the website if you want to do it that way. Or if you want to help keep this show alive, you can always become a patron. And that will actually get you access to our Telegram crew. We got a really awesome, dedicated group of Bitcoiners in there. And we are actually just talking about, I'm not sure if y'all heard about this, but the Fed is launching a treasury bill buy for like $60 billion per month. Like this is actually more than, I'm pretty sure QE2 was $50 billion per month. So it's crazy. And we've been chatting a little bit about what the hell that means for Bitcoin and, you know, what the hell's going to happen with the economy going forward. So we talk about all kinds of crazy stuff and obviously share a lot of great content to be read on the show. So if anybody would like to join us in the Crypto Economy crew, don't forget to go to patreon.com/thecryptoeconomy, become a supporter, and you will get access to our crew. And as little as $1 a month, it really goes a long way to help keeping this thing alive. Knowing that I'm making a little bit of money back from this with, a couple of advertisers and then everybody who has been so generous in donating to this show. Thank you guys so much. It really is awesome to know that y'all appreciate this as much as you do. So thank you, thank you. And don't forget to check that out. And lastly, if you can't support the show, you know what you can do? Share it. Share it with everybody you know in the Bitcoin and crypto economy space. Thank you so much for listening, guys. We will be back here with the next section of Sovereignty Through Mathematics tomorrow. This is The Crypto Economy. I am Guy Swan. And until next time, take it easy, everybody. We'll be right back.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.